Accession number 30109.
Are you counting this real six?
Yes, I mean it's all happening very quickly. It's very quiet, very silent. You've broken the surface. You're not going to drown, at least. Pulled the handle on my Mae West to reflect my life jacket. Didn't work. Not my day. Sort of in so doing that, you sort of treading water, looking around you a little bit, and then thinking, hang on, where's Andy? Well, you know, your brain does actually start to clear a little bit now, and you sort of say, well, hang on, where's he? And more or less as I sort of thought that and actually thought, oh my God, have I got to go dive going back there again and try and find him? You know, not that I wouldn't have done, but it was still just a brief second, oh shit, I'm going to have to go back down there again. And he broke surface himself, and he really just bobbed to the surface next to me. I reckon he would have got out of the aircraft at least a sort of 10, 12 foot mark as it was sinking. Burning him on, he had a full 5-point harness to get rid of and everything else and the controls and everything else in the aircraft. So he sort of bobbed at the surface next to me. Quite pale looking, obviously. Mind you, I didn't have an idea what I looked like at that time either. And all he said was, help me, Eddie, I'm hurt, mate. Yeah, fine, you know, didn't elaborate, he didn't do anything. Pulled him to me, and pulled his Mae West release anyway, which inflated. So a little bit of self-preservation, but, oh, thank God, I can took my hand through here, he's going to float, I'm going to float, sort of thing as well. And sort of, by now, I suppose, I was probably sort of treading water, looking at the beach that we'd just missed, probably 40 or 50 metres out from us, I would think. Because of where Andy's come up and I've pulled him to me, he in effect is now the outboard side or the seaboard side of the shoreline now and everything else. And you know, the hearing's starting to clear, the water's running out the helmet, you're starting to get a grip of things a bit more now, and started to watch splashes in the water all around us. And immediate reaction was, so I thought the, because we had all the armament made, I thought the electrical contacts and the rockets perhaps had started to short, and some of these were firing off underneath us because where the aircraft had sunk, something like that. But the, like I say, the hearing is clearing and everything else, and that sort of post-crash aftermath. And quickly realised there was a bang followed by a splash, and because you're sort of in the water, sort of, you know, at beach level, as you're looking, sort of now look a little bit further up, 50, 75, 80 metres up the beach, up in the undergrowth now, I can see these blokes shooting us. Patently they're Argentines, you can see that straight away. People with rifles who actually taking pot shots at us. And I went, oops, this is not so good. Well, I think going to the beach is out. you know, pretty much in the reputation, they just run down and kick us to death or whatever, if that's what they want to be. Couldn't see why they're... Remember, I probably even... Memory's not like that. I'm probably stupid enough to shout something like, you bastards, leave us alone or something. But it seemed unfair, I must be perfectly honest. You know, we haven't got the aircraft anymore. No threat to you. Why are you trying to kill me, you know? Anyway, not to be. Beach is out. Across the water where we'd been previously, when we were flying, Cameron's Point went, it's a bit of a hike, and I don't know who's over there. I knew no troops were due to go there of ours, because obviously I said I knew the battle plans where people were going to be. So no one's scheduled to be. Then you think, well, I'm going to hike all the way across there for what? I mean, somewhere else to be. So really it was a question of looking over your left shoulder and back westward again and say, well, there's the settlement. It's about 500, possibly 600 metres sort of thing. But that's the logical way to go. We're putting distance between this and the crash site and still making some distance. And that's what I started doing almost straight away. I didn't bother even thinking anything else through. Really was my arm, my right arm was stuck through the vest of Andy's Mae West, tucked in and sort of locked in so I couldn't fall off it, basically. I lay on my back and was just swimming using my legs, basically, on my back, you know, the old sort of recovery type of stroke. And he was still talking to me off and on. Wasn't saying a lot, but he was lucid enough when he did speak, and he just said, you know, geez, I think I'm badly hurt, but, you know, how are we going? I, he didn't know, he had, I'm convinced he had no idea we'd been shot at. I don't think he knew people were shooting at us. I think he was just very conscious of being in the water, and he probably cold, because I was. And really, it was just like, just hear me say to him, encourage yourself, it won't be long, mate, I'll get you ashore first, and that was it. So, and we just kept swimming, and the shooting sort of died off. And I thought, well, fair enough, you've given up on that one, that's fair enough. I'm probably about halfway by then. Kept swimming a bit more, and it was getting more and more like swimming in treacle. I mean, really, I was getting cold, very tired. Hadn't even given the slightest consideration what we're going to do once we got ashore. Hadn't even thought about what comes next. It was more just to get away from these people shooting at us and get us somewhere that's got solid land underneath us, you know. Thought, bugger it, I'm going to get this bloody Mae West of mine on the cracks, because it's getting hard work even holding on. Just, oh, now it decides to work. Big bright orange target, because that's exactly what it must have presented, because they started shooting again. I thought, this is not fair, you know, leave us alone. I got actually that fed up, and I'd actually watched rounds land and pattern on either side. It was just, well, they weren't good shots. I had one go between my legs as I was lying my back swimming. I just thought, I've had enough of this. I really don't want to know anymore. Decided what I did was change to put my left hand through Andy's vest and be lying on my side so I could look ahead to where we were going and sort of swimming like a side stroke type of thing. And I remember sort of even thinking at the time that, you know, if you're going to hit me now, well, I won't even see it coming. I won't be watching these bullets land near me and determine how close you're getting. Within the last 150 metres by now, 100-150 metres, I suppose, from the shoreline, saw people at the shoreline, could quickly made out, well, they weren't in uniform, so there was a good chance they were locals. Shouted something like, hey, give us a hand, we're British, or whatever. Not that I knew that they knew, anyway. And yeah, 2020 knowledge, of course, you realise that there's no boat that beats shells very quickly. It's not an easy way of coming to help us in that respect, anyway. Sort of, I mean, you're getting there, you're in the last little bit of it now, and one of the guys must have decided to have a last crack, because the shooting had gone a bit more sporadic again, but they were still there on occasions. And one round must have gone right just over the top of my head, because it splashed almost in front of my face as I'm, you know, come from behind me as I'm going along. And the second round, if I'd have been lying doing a normal stroke on my chest and things, I reckon it hit me right between the shoulder blades, because I felt the impact of this, the shock of the water, it hit me on the back of the sort of neck area. Just the shock of it entering the water was that close. Adrenaline is brown, it does run down your leg. We managed to make the last sort of 30 metres onto the beach. Civvies were organised, they had a little stretcher there, and they had picked up, we were Brits, which was great. So you're trying to get this helmet off so you can actually talk to people, otherwise you're not going to hear and understand what they're saying. And they probably quickly introduced themselves, all of them. Really, until recent times, I didn't know the names of some. I knew Fred Ford as the only one I had picked up on, who was one of the older blokes who helped us. And we went to the local, one of the bunkhouses there in the settlement. There's Andy's on the stretcher. He's sort of saying, you know, oh, that's better. But, you know, I think he was glad to be out of the water. I think he was conscious he was out of the water. Just as we're setting off with the stretcher, I hear another Gazelle helicopter. And I think, yeah, someone has come to look for us then. Because I'd set one of the beacons running on the way back as well. When I got Andy's jacket ring, got his beacon going as well. In the background, at least, that would be beeping away for someone to come and find. Thought, right. And saw this Gazelle looking again to the south, going straight along the same bit of terrain we had, along Cameron's Point side of the water. But he was actually going at quite a speed. Oh, where's he going? And as he got just beyond Cameron's Point, he seen a very hard left turn to come back over the northern shore, and started the climb in the course of that turn as well. And I thought, because all he did was fly straight into the Argentinians. knew where they'd been shooting at me, and I think they would have heard the gazelle as much as I did. And I mean, he probably even presented a more threatening target to them. I mean, they would have looked like maybe he had turned to attack them. Maybe they thought I'd called from or something. But anyway, just got hit with a fusillade of shots. I mean, basically, all rifle fire. I mean, there were no machine guns involved. This was just rifles, but. The front of the aircraft just basically disintegrated, the canopy disintegrated, and it stopped. It was about 70 foot above the ground. It stopped like it hit a brick wall. I mean, it's a bang, and just dropped. And dropped that 70 feet, and I mean, it crumpled and crashed the bar. Look, and that's, what, 700 metres away from me or something like that? It's a long distance, you know, but the image is imprinted in my brain. I can just see even that distance. You couldn't see the specifics, but you can see the impact of it just arriving. And so, you know, whoever it was, in my own mind, I said straight away at that point, was a couple of old people just died. You know, no two ways about it. Just get back to the living and the wounded, and that's or the injured, rather, I should say, because I didn't know he was wounded. Let's get sorted out. We went in the farmhouse, an old deer in there whose house it was. She was crying, which, you know, was a little hard to take to begin with, and then realised she was upset that mate was injured and all the rest of it sort of thing. Actually, she was also crying because they were only just getting the news that round the corner 5,000 troops are coming ashore. They didn't know, you see, they'd been isolated from a lot of information. You know, they'd said on the way back to the farmhouse, one of them said, I don't know where we're going to hide, we've got to find someone. Hide me? Why would I want to go and hide? The brigade's coming round the corner. Well, we'll have them bastards very shortly afterwards, sort of thing. So that was, again, the news hadn't been too clear to them, so that was fine. I mean, got Eddie into there, sort of got him in a half sitting position, because he was starting to say about trying to breathe, it was painful, and he was holding his abdomen all the way through, and he never once said to me he'd been shot. I don't even know for certain that he even knew it. I certainly didn't until later. My thought had been that in the impact on the water, the instrument panel controls, everything was thrown back at him, and he'd effectively got crush injuries and things of that nature. And that's what it appeared to be. And he's holding his abdomen, and he's having a problem starting to breathe. So you start to do that first aid bit, and there's no obvious bleeding because there wasn't. It's that internal injury stuff. So got him half sitting, cut the neck rubber seal on his suit so he could breathe a bit easier. He actually was a bit easier there for a while, and he said something about his leg was hurting, his right leg, so it was worked in from the bottom and sort of cut open the, you know, many of these immersion suits are also rubberized material, and they're quite strong, so you get a pair of scissors and crack in trying to get there. And basically he got to the sort of groin area and came across a lot of blood. I thought, oh my God, where's this coming from? First aid doesn't cover some of these things. Seriously, still at that stage in time of the honest belief that internal injuries, that somehow his bowel or bladder were just discharging the blood that I was finding. Shit, what do you do for this, you know? Throughout all this, to be fair, the civvies are working very hard. They've actually used the internal phone line within the settlement, and they've called back across the way, because of course three paras coming ashore about a K and a half away to the west, so they've used their internal network basically to get someone to go and tell the paras that there's a bloke down here that's injured and everything else and all that sort of stuff. Fred's got the 303 rifle out of the hiding place. He's had it all the time there. He used to be in the Defence Force down there, and it was a bit of a underground going on, and he was very much an active part of it, and posted one of the other islanders with the rifle and binos to watch what the Argentine group was doing, just in case they chose to come back and have a crack in the farmhouse. So all the time there's like a lot of concurrent activity happening. So we basically start to try to staunch any blood that we can, and try and talk to him. He's keeps dropping unconscious every so often as well now, and I'm sort of starting to get a little bit more concerned. Up to now, I've not been that concerned. I thought we were in an injured situation that we could probably recover from. He came back conscious again for a while and started telling me he was bloody cold, and I could see the blueing of the lips starting to take place and everything. I thought, oh shit, we don't need this. You know, where's this fucking medic, you know, supposed to be coming? desperation. I mean, what do I do? I don't know what to do in this situation. What else can I do, you know? He basically stopped breathing. As simple as that. And as soon as that occurred, it was start trying to give mouth to mouth, and working on that. And I looked at one of the other people, he's about 18 years of age, one of the lads, John Thane, who knew that sort of thing as well and was helping me. I don't know. He's probably been in the farmhouse for about 15, 20 minutes at that point, maybe around that. Within another 10 minutes, it probably wasn't even that long. This paramedic, or RMC guy, I should say, attached to Paris, came bursting through the door. Never found his name. Brave lad. He'd actually disobeyed orders. He'd got the message at the other end where they were coming ashore, and his boss had said, "You've got to wait, we haven't cleared the village yet, baby shops, all these type of things." Didn't know who was there. And he basically said, "Stuff it," and actually run all the way through the village, not knowing what could have been lying away from to get to where we were, and see if he could use his medical skills, probably better than mine, in terms of any assistance. He wasn't able to. I mean, in fact, you know, within a minute, I said, "Mate, you know, there's no chance. Afraid, you know, can't do any more," sort of thing. Whereupon I probably remember putting my fist through the wall of the room. They're only like a wooden structure, just in sheer frustration. I didn't feel guilty about destroying this lady's wall, you know. He went, "Well, yeah, now what?" And walked out the back of this place. "Has anyone got any cigarettes? I need a cigarette." "Thank you." I walk out the back of this farmhouse, which right out the back of me, there was a little small slope hillside thing out the back. And as I walked out the back, I got a bloody rifle shoved in my nose. And paratroopers on the other end of it. I came up bloody close to getting shot, because by now I'd taken my immersion suit off. So I was in denims and a pullover, and of course with my marine flashes on. But I've got no bearing, I've got no gun in my hand. He nearly shot me, because they actually knew about the Argentines robbing the original detachment's kit as well. So, well, I don't look Spanish, I don't think, but I'm in the situation. They just weren't expecting to find me there. Luckily, he didn't shoot me, thank God. That was the paras rocking up. The lead elements, some guys had been sent to find this medic and what he'd got up to, and so another section sort of raced down there to find out. And quickly followed them. I mean, they moved through fairly quickly then. The company commander was down and was able to brief them what had happened, where the second aircraft was. Can you start to think then, I know where the second aircraft is, you know nothing about. And, hey, look, I've assumed they're dead, but, you know, there's people there. And that's where the Argentine people are. The guy with the binos, and the civilians are keeping an eye on them, this sort of thing. And, gave them the brief about where they should go and look and see if they could do me a favour and catch up with them. And really, after that, it was a question of Fred and John Thane, the civvies, and Fred's Land Rover, his little blue Land Rover, the white top. We put Andy's body in the back of that and headed off back towards the beach where the paras were coming in. It was about, about a K and a half away, and sort of rocked up down this beach where you can see the paras still coming in, the mortar platoons digging in, just sort of thing, and all the rest of it. And just as we arrived, you know, someone shouts, "Air raid warning red." I mean, this was the sort of first air raids of the day, you see. I went, gets out of this bloody vehicle, and someone started screaming at Fred, "Get that fucking vehicle off the bed." I mean, imagine blue and white, you know, it probably wasn't a good idea. So we went and parked that and left Andy's body under a boulder and decided to take cover. Just as the first jet came in, and realised this young lad had been helping on the mouth to mouth and things, everything, and grabbed him and threw him in the bottom of this little shell scrape that I hadn't dug, but it doesn't matter, it was there and it was empty, and jumped on top of him to cover him and get your head down so to stay down out of the way. I remember feeling very, very guilty at that point, because I suddenly realised that these people are trying to help me with someone now being exposed to my world. I mean, it's my world, it's what I do. And I felt this sort of sudden degree of guilt I was putting them at even more risk and things. Went through this sort of first air raid and didn't really target us too much directly, and we managed to get up and think about what we're going to do next. Got a fair there, right? Wasn't getting a ride off the beach at that time either. It was all rather confusing. Mortar troop fire, or the mortar troop from the Paris fire, a mission downrange. I remember some, he might have been the officer, I'm not sure. I remember asking what the target was, and he wasn't going to tell me. Oh, thanks very much. But I'm about to tell him if it was the group that hit me, they would put some white phosphorus in amongst it, might just do the job, sort of attitude, the way I felt at that time. But anyway, eventually a couple of raiding craft came along. I knew the sergeant coxswain of one of them quite well. He saw me, he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, told him the story." He knew Andy as well. So he come, got Andy's body onto one of the boats and me onto the other. Drove back out to the Canberra, because that's what we've been told in the brief. Everyone went back to Canberra, was the argument. Got to Canberra, arrived alongside the band, Royal Mint Bandsmen, who provided the stretcher party and everything. Did a good job, actually, those guys were bloody good. They got involved, took Andy's body up to the top, and I've got Andy's helmets and my Mae West, and his Mae West, all the little bits of package, and bimble up the side of the ship, and sort of, I'm made to sit down there on the upper deck. I haven't been on Canberra the whole time I'm there, and it's a promenade deck, and that's it. You're sort of into the medical system, and these guys, these Navy medics, and they were blue Navy rather than green attached to the Marine type Navy. There's quite a distinct difference. The guys that work with do understand us a lot. And they've put the old hospital tag wrist around your wrist and everything else, and they're sorting the gear out. Going to put my helmet with Andy's Mae West and vice versa. They've got the names all over them. Remember exploding on the blokes doing this. So get it right, because someone's going to get told someone's dead and someone's not. And if you get these things all mixed up, it's all going to be wrong. And then when you put this tag on, and they wonder with this sort of manic laughter, and I'm just actually pissing myself laughing. I just got pretty shocked, obviously, as well, but just couldn't stop laughing. And he said, couldn't see the humour. I said, look at that. He said, yeah, it's your medic back number, And I said, yeah, look at it. He didn't get 007. Couldn't stop laughing. Sat there for a while, waiting for the system. Saw all these stretchers off down to the left. About 10 or 15 of them, actually. All with the people on them. I thought, geez, we're taking some casualties there. And then realised there was a different coloured uniform. So I thought I'd take a little bimble down there and have a look, see what I was looking at. Got near to the first stretcher, and sure enough, they were all Argentines. They're up funny head, it turns out, some of the ones that have been wounded from that morning. And this sort of face looks up at me, and it was probably an extremely nervous smile, the truth be known, but in my state of mind, I interpret that immediately as some sort of arrogant sneer. So as I kicked him in his side, which is probably not the right thing to do, this lieutenant commander in the Navy, some medical bloke, blue uniform, I don't know what I was doing, God, do that, and they grabbed me and everything else, and it was, whatever, and I'm sort of not bothered. And I couldn't mean to hurt him, and they went, why? I immediately pulled a 9mm pistol out of the back of my trousers where I'd shoved it earlier. I said, could I use this, wouldn't I? And banged up against the wall. He wants to wrestle this gun from my hand. He obviously thinks he's got a loony on his hands now. Snatched it back out of his hand, actually, because he was getting more danger than me and himself trying to unload the weapon. I said, look, unload it that way there. Please take it away, sir. Go, and then got taken down and effectively in the medical system. A lot of those, like I said, there wasn't very much wrong with it. Apparently I was covered in blood and things on the face, but it was partly someone else's and it was partly mine. What I didn't know, the bridge of my nose had been cut open with my visor on my helmet, and first time I'd seen myself in the mirror, I'm covered in blood, actually, but recovering and just into the system. Went for a brief holiday all the way down to South Georgia, and going all the way back on Canberra, thank God, and back on the islands and rejoined the flight for the rest of the war.
What did that involve when you got back with the flight? How long did you have been downtown South Georgia?
Oh, only as long as the camera took to sell down the back, so it was about 5 days or so, the round trip, I think. Originally I was supposed to have to go home and all the rest of it, and I managed to provide people there was no reason why I was going home. There was nothing to go home for, and my job, which I was perfectly capable of doing back on the islands. The senior naval psychologist Morgan O'Connell, who I got to know quite well, had done some work with us as a group on the way down, sort of thing, on the way down to South Georgia. And in fact, he was the guy that got me permission to go back on the islands. Otherwise, they just arbitrarily said, go home. And he said, no, he said, actually, there's nothing wrong with you. You've got it rationed out, rationalised and reasoned out. And then he said, well, you know, what are you going to do there with the guys on the flight deck when you're back if you're like an unlucky omen or whatever, this type of thing? And I said, well, I'm a rifle troop sergeant. I'm going to keep losing people the way we're losing them. There's a job for me somewhere. And he said, but I don't think that's going to be the case. And yeah, luckily it wasn't. You know, got back, got picked up, got down to the flight location again. And
where were they when you got back?
They'd moved ashore by then. They were right down the bottom end of San Carlos Water, in a little gully. Obviously, because we'd lost the two aircraft. We only had one left. In fact, we'd now been borrowed one or lent one by one of the other flights, so we had a two-aircraft flight, down to, 19 of us by then. So I was a fairly close-knit little group by then. I mean, obviously, I didn't experience, obviously, later I've heard all about, obviously, when the guys found out that they'd lost two aircraft of the flight. I was dead for 24 hours or so, apparently. I mean, they even had a wake for me and all the rest of the guys, sort of routine. While I was on Canberra, I obviously found out who the crew were of the other aircraft. In fact, they were brought on board later. They were buried at sea off Canberra on that Saturday, on the night anyway, the first night we were there. I actually read the lesson and all those sort of things. So there was someone there for them. That was quite traumatic, watching someone buried at sea. Never seen that. But, like, when I got back, I mean, no, the guys were great. I mean, it was really, they wanted me back, and it was seen as a positive rather than a negative. And I was glad to be back with them. They have a very, very close sense of bonding. No, and I don't mean just with the aircrew guys. I mean the whole flight, the corporals and marines and things and everything else. And that was just exhibited just this Sunday gone with the parade. And there's a couple of guys there who are marines who I haven't seen since that point in time. Never crossed again in my career. Quite an emotional reoccurrence to actually meet up with these guys again. Good people, you know. And saw out basically the rest of the war. I mean, did some flying, not as much as I would have liked, but then again, we only had two aircraft with which to do it. Helped just, you know, be part of the flight and run the various bits and pieces. Did some CP work because obviously, you know, with my ops background again, radios coming in after all these years again, but obviously could do stuff like that and help out there with some of the planning side. And yeah, we finished off, stuck out at Teal Inlet, saw out the end of the war. I mean, we did a fair bit of flying, Kazovac and resupply and stuff in the meantime. Never really, I don't think as a flight location, never got exposed to any real danger at any subsequent stage. You know, general stuff, but nothing too specific. Never really targeted that hard. A couple of the trips in the aircraft were a bit hairy, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
What were the kind of duration of these, you know, resupply flight or Kazovac?
Well, a lot of them are taking place at night for obvious reasons. So what really should be like, you know, a half hour, 40-minute job, you probably spend an hour and 20 on. Mainly because you're going to go that much slower and lower, and people are using, well, not like the modern night vision goggles, the old PNG, passive night goggles they had previously, which were, well, they're probably better than nothing, but, you know, snowstorms affect them, let alone anything, let alone flares going off and mortar bombs exploding. And like one of the other guys in the flight said, you know, that's the beauty of flying these helicopters. He said he sat there the other night, he was doing a resupply, and mortar rounds are going off nearby, and we couldn't hear them. Then it goes dark, and he wondered why I think it was the Paras he was resupplying that time, you know, why there was sort of jumping and flown themselves to the ground and things. He's trying to get, because he's just sat on the ground. In fact, not even sat fully on the ground, because we used to stay off the ground as much as possible because the mines that we didn't know about always, and he might have got there, but there might be a mine here. And what are you doing? Get the stuff out. You don't want to go. And trying to shout at him, grab his microphone and say, like, mortaring. Oh, really? Well, we better leave then. And it's just like it's a different world, because you can't hear it above the noise of the aircraft.